Со двора подъезд известный под названием «Черный ход». В том подъезде, как в поместье, проживает черный кот. Он в усы усмешку прячет, темнота ему как щит. Все коты поют и плачут.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sean Guillory. Every podcast, I talk to an author about their new book on Russia or Eurasia. In this episode, I spoke to Doug Rogers about his book, The Old Faith in the Russian Land, a historical ethnography of ethics in the Urals. One of my own research interests concerns the ways communities establish and regulate ethical practice. Ethics concerns the ways groups define what is proper, good, and virtuous, and how their practice constitutes identities and subject positions. This is why I was attracted to Doug Rogers' The Old Faith in the Russian Land. I was not disappointed. By blending history with ethnography, Rogers carefully uncovers how the old believer community in the small Russian town of Sepich renegotiated its ethical practices in regard to religious ritual, labor, gender, and generation in three historical moments: the abolition of serfdom, the establishment of Soviet power, and the collapse of communism. His findings not only point to the resilience of old belief in maintaining its convictions and practices, but also its adaptability to the pressures of modernity. So for more on ethics and its history in Sepich, I give you my interview with Doug. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Sean.
Welcome to New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for taking the time to talk about your book, The Old Faith in the Russian Land, a historical ethnography of ethics in the Urals.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right. Well, just to start, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into studying the anthropology of Russia?
Well, I guess this goes back to my undergraduate days. I was an undergraduate at Middlebury College and taking courses in anthropology and continuing to take Russian after high school. And the two sort of merged with a third interest of mine at the time, which was religion. And I have, somewhat to my horror, been writing the same book ever since. The first time I did some research on old believers was actually for my senior thesis in college. I was spending a semester at Moscow State University and got to know some Russian scholars, archaeographers, who are some of the most well-known scholars of old belief in Russia. And they invited me on an expedition with them in the summer of 1994. To go visit old believer communities in the Perm region. So that was the first time actually that I had done field research with them about old believers, and things have sort of continued on since then.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to write this particular book?
Well, this particular book is sort of a confluence of a couple of things. A sort of return after a break to thinking about old belief already at this point when I was in graduate school in anthropology at Michigan. And there are sort of two, I guess, intellectual trajectories that this book is situated in and which I was thinking about. And the first of them is that this is really a historical ethnography, which is a sort of genre of anthropology and a genre of history that is or has been particularly underdeveloped in the study of Russia and the former Soviet Union. There's a bunch of anthropology on this region after the end of the Soviet Union, and there's always been terrific history. But the insights that can be gained from combining fieldwork and archival research, from thinking about the past through the prism of the present and vice versa, is really a vein that I think has been underexplored in this part of the world. And so I really wanted to sort of push this line. So this book is based on over a year of field research in a village, a small town in the Urals called Sepich, and also on about 8 or 9 months of fairly solid archive work in Moscow and in Perm and in some other places. So it's really throughout the book I'm trying to sort of use history and anthropology complementarily and in tension with each other to get a better understanding of what's been going on in this particular place and in Russia more broadly over about three centuries. So that's intellectual trend number one that is sort of behind this book. And the second one is more particular to anthropology and the anthropology of religion. And that has been the idea that it's a useful thing to think about and to theorize the issue of ethics. And this is really a comprehensive historical ethnography of ethics. It tries to work through the ways in which people have sought to fashion for themselves ethical lives in changing circumstances in a single place over three centuries. So that's the intellectual sort of confluence that's behind this book, these two things.
Mm-hmm. Now, it is, as you said, your book is primarily about a history of ethics and also morality in this small town of Sepich in Perm. Talk a bit about what you mean by ethics. How do you define it?
So I have a fairly broad understanding of ethics as these definitions go. I basically understand it to be a field of socially located and culturally informed and historically situated practices that are undertaken with at least sort of partial consciousness, some sort of partially conscious orientation towards conceptions of what's good or proper or virtuous. So that's a fairly broad definition, but let me try to say a little bit more about what I mean by it. So what I'm trying to capture here is the way that people seek to act in the world, seek to engage in social and cultural practice by orienting themselves to an understanding of goodness, which could come from a variety of sources, from religious texts or from sensibilities about what kind of economic actions are good or bad or political actions. So fairly broad there. I do want to insist, and I insist throughout the book, that ethics is to be understood as at the same time a social, like cultural, and a historical phenomenon. So socially, it matters who you are in a sort of social context, how you're able to act and what counts as good. So it may make a difference between men and women or old or young or people of different sort of social classes. So these have important impacts on how ethics works. It matters culturally in the sense of there are particular kinds of meaningful action within which ethical practice is situated. So what are the kinds of ways, particularly in this one particular village, this old believer village, that people sought to create meaningful lives? And then the third thing is that it's historically situated, is that these things are always changing. And this is really the main part of what I want to do in this book, is track this series of transformations and the sedimentation of different sets of sensibilities of what counts as good or how one tries to accomplish good or virtue in the world. And then the first part of my definition is that it's a field of action. So there's no one particular thing. I don't have a list of the five principles orienting ethical action in Sepich. It's a very diverse and practical field where people have different conceptions. And what I'm trying to do is trace how these different conceptions enter the world at different times. And why would it be that somebody's understanding of ethics at a particular time is more powerful than another person's? So these always exist in a social field of competition and collaboration. And one of the historical questions is, you know, how do large-scale historical changes, whether it's emancipation in the 1860s or the coming of socialism or the end of socialism, change the context of the world such that it creates new kinds of dilemmas and possibilities for people to act ethically?
I would imagine, too, it's also relational. I mean, you mentioned the contextual aspect, but also in terms of one's location within a community, but it's also who that person is dealing with. The relations between two types of people, I would imagine ethical practice varies, say, if a young is dealing with an old or someone prominent in the village is dealing with, say, a lay person.
Absolutely. So it's precisely in those sort of social fault lines that a lot of the sort of engines of historical change become visible, right? Where how is it that you have to change the way you act with respect to elders in the context of socialism in the way that you might not have in the context of sort of post-emancipation capitalism? Or how is it that outsiders who are not people from Sepich, who are not old believers, or not collective farmers or peasants, how do you relate to them? What counts and what is effective action with relation to different sorts of people. So that's exactly right. And how the same person acts differently in different contexts is the thing I come back to again and again in the book.
And a lot of people, though, however, sometimes confuse ethics from morality. And morality is another issue that you deal with. What's the difference between the two in your analytical apparatus?
Yeah, I mean, this can go very quickly and very deeply into the weeds of sort of moral and ethical philosophy, and there's a lot of disagreement, and I just sort of make a decision in the book that ethics is basically a domain of practice, mm-hmm. and morality is the domain of sort of oughts and shoulds. So one of the things I'm very concerned with in the text is how moralizing discourses, so this is the morality part, impact or have the power to shape ethical practices. So, for example, how does the arrival of a particular preacher, this is an important scene in the post-Soviet period, the arrival of a missionary priest from, not from a sort of Western Protestant, sort of the classical mission to the former Soviet world after the end of the Soviet Union, but an old believer missionary priest who's very into preaching and very into moralizing discourses, right? This is how you must live. Mm-hmm. This is how you should live in a way that recalls really the builders of socialism and the builders of markets after the end of serfdom. All of these moralizing discourses brought by outsiders, these sort of very carefully elaborated how you should act, you know, the moral codex for the builder of communism, all of this stuff is the domain of morality. But what I'm interested in is how those things have or do not have impacts on life in this town, right? How do they actually change people's practices?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't.
Right.
And sometimes they do in ways that were not at all foreseen or intended by the people who were preaching them. So there, for my purposes, and other people who write on these topics in anthropology might do it differently, but for my purposes, that's where I see a useful analytical difference between ethics and morality.
Mm-hmm. So there's also an existing tension between, I like the way you put it, how one ought to act and how one actually does act. And you're interested in the actual practices of the ought.
Yeah, right. It's the practices of the ought, because in everyday life it never works out.
Exactly. Exactly.
Although that moment of striving, right, that moment mm-hmm. of saying I'm going to try to be like this, is the one I'm after as a very important moment in the formation of subjects, of human subjects, and of communities. So, and across domains, right? It's not. And one of the things that I certainly want to say to other anthropologists who work on ethics and morality is that I think it's not just a matter of religion. And one of the things that I'm arguing in the book is that domain of ethical practice can be just as much in the field of trying to build a socialist, you know, rural economy, as in, you know, trying to live up to the particular precepts of old belief.
Yeah, I would, as one who looks at the ethics of revolutionary Russia, its ethics is completely suffused in the Soviet project. It's incredibly, I mean, the amount of detail they spend on, say, how does one act as a comrade, for example, is quite
right.
Revealing. Okay.
Right.
So,
and then,
go ahead.
And then for me, you know, so what happens when, you know, you learn all this stuff about how to act as a comrade, and then what do you do when you go home and your grandmother is this, you know, very, you know, believing, faithful old believer and thinks that the way you just learned how to act is not appropriate. So
exactly.
What do you do in that context? So.
Exactly. So the other poll, so you're primarily looking at this through religion and old belief in particular. Talk a bit about old belief for people who aren't really clear on what Russian Orthodoxy is and
sure,
old belief.
Sure. So the sort of conventional story of who the old believers are that's told in a number of textbooks and is sort of out there in the popular imagination is that the Russian Orthodox Church was sort of going along happily until the middle of the 17th century, when the patriarch at the time, Patriarch Nikon, in conjunction with the Tsar, decided that there needed to be some changes made in the rituals and services of Russian Orthodoxy in order to update it. And The conventional story goes that a large part of the Russian Orthodox believing population rejected these reforms as being out of step with their experience of Orthodoxy and not true to Orthodoxy, and that they felt so strongly about this that they preferred to go into schism and create a division in the Russian Orthodox Church than to adapt their practices. So from that moment forward, from the middle of the 17th century forward, you have the continuation of the mainstream Russian Orthodox Church and also dissenting old believers who are marked by their insistence on retaining those old service books and old rituals. There are various factions of old believers. The biggest one and one that has significant import for the history of this town of Sepich is between priestly and priestless old believers. So priestly old believers still retain a church and a hierarchy that looks very much in a sort of structural way like the Russian Orthodox Church, but is not and claims to be the legitimate remaining Russian Orthodox Church. And then there are these priestless groups of old believers who believe that with these reforms in the 17th century, all sanctity and sacraments and the possibility of a priesthood left the world. And so so there are priestless communities that are that don't have an ordained priesthood associated with them. So that's the conventional story. More recently, historians have been challenging this narrative and saying that although there are certainly old belief is certainly a powerful movement now and has been. It did not originate with a sort of unified mass protest or mass rejection of the Russian Orthodox reforms. There was, in fact, at this point in Russian history, a wide variety of dissent sort of circulating in lots of different groups of dissenters. And it was only somewhat later, as much as 50 or 75 years later, into the 18th century, that an old believer movement was created out of all these variety of other groups that were somehow dissenters. So in this version, which is one that I support and I think the history of Sepich supports, you have old belief as a unified movement, whether priestly or priestless, emerging as a sort of conscious creation of dissent.
I would imagine that it's also because these are persecuted people in the hands of the state and the church.
Yes, there's nothing. Yes, there's nothing to sort of round up or solidify an opposition like persecution, right? So I think that's part of exactly as you say. I think that's part of the unifying factor here.
Talk a bit about old belief in Sepich, and in particular, the key elements of its ethical repertoire.
Sure. So this is really the concern of the first two chapters of the first part of the book is to talk about the formation in Sepich in the 18th and into the 19th century of what I call an ethical repertoire. Ethical repertoire, you know, if we think back to the kind of definition of ethics that I used, where there's not sort of a firm set of precepts, it's a set of practice and they change a lot. I use this concept of an ethical repertoire to try to get at the way in which things have changed enormously over these three centuries. But there's a malleable protein set of expectations about how to live an ethical life that I think we can still discern, even moving through these different contexts, even as different pieces of them change and change drastically. We can see them as parts of an ongoing repertoire. And so what I'm wanting to do in the first two chapters, which is based on largely on archival research, particularly with old believer manuscripts written in Sepich, and then some other sort of more conventional sources for the history of the period, is to elaborate the different pieces of this ethical repertoire that I then trace into the Soviet period and the post-Soviet period. And a lot of them have to do with the fact that this community was founded as an old believer community. It's actually founded twice, and this goes back to my definition of old belief. It seemed the first settlers that we know about in Sepich were in the very late 1600s, 1690s, who do seem to have been religious dissenters, but were not at that point calling themselves old believers. And then in 1730 or 1731, a traveling preacher arrives in the town, and he is assertively an Old Believer. And it seems that he is part of this movement of stitching together all these different dissenting groups into a unified Old Believer movement. And at that point, we start to get a very developed manuscript record of debates about old belief, about religion, about life in the world. This town of Sepich and the surrounding area were part of the Stroganov family landholdings. So these are sort of classic serfs in the Russian sense. So there's a lot of debates about how one reconciles the demands of old belief with worldly ethics and worldly production and things like that. So I use this these manuscripts and these other sort of landholding records to elaborate some of the elements of the ethical repertoire that's particular to this place. So I'll just mention a couple of them that are important. One of them is that over the course of the 18th and 19th centuries, there comes to be a very sharp generational divide with respect to religious practice. People were active, ritually participating old believers of the priestless sort. This has been, since its founding, a priestless town. So people did not take up the actual practice of old belief until later in life. So they worked quite freely in the world, as they would say, on the Stroganov estates, and fully participating in monetary exchange and sexual lives and marriage lives and reproduction and all this stuff that, from the perspective of active old believers, was sinful and was taking one away from the possibility of salvation, until the point at which they a spouse dies and they sort of withdraw from the world into this ascetic, monastically inspired set of practices, where the point is to avoid everything to do with the world, money, labor that is alienated, sex, reproduction, any of these things become temptations and to be avoided at all costs. So this is quite particular, this very strong generational divide between sort of middle-aged people working in the fields and as serfs, and then elders at one point sort of converting to being active old believers and withdrawing from the world. So that's an important part of the local ethical repertoire. Another thing very early on is very developed debates about gender and marriage, and whether religious authority can proceed through women or not. This is a key aspect of debates about ethics as it intersects with both religious practice and the sort of organization of the Stroganov family estates in the 18th and 19th. Centuries. So those are two aspects, and tracing out these debates allows me then to sort of set a baseline for changes that happen later on.
Part of this ethical repertoire goes throughout the history of the town, and it becomes an issue of debate at particular moments in its history.
That's right. I mean, I think this is my argument, is that we can see elements of even those early debates about, I call them gender and generation, as a sort of shorthand, we can see elements of that even now in the post-Soviet period in Sepich that are quite clearly continuations of these earlier things, entirely transformed by the Soviet period and, you know, entirely embedded in contemporary global capitalism, but in some ways continuing this sort of long-running conversation about how do I act ethically in the world with respect to generation and gender, mm-hmm. in both religious and economic spheres.
Well, your book is based on three historical moments that allow for this these periods of ethical renegotiation, the first of which is after the abolition of serfdom in the 1860s, where the community is split between two old believer groups, the Maksimovsky and the Demenyovsky communities. Talk about this schism and how this symbolized the changing ethical atmosphere in the town.
Right. So this is sort of the puzzle that I present is, you know, how do we have an ongoing ethical repertoire, but yet all of this change? And I identify these three moments, the period after emancipation, the Soviet period, and then the post-Soviet period, where we get particularly dramatic change that hooks into Sepich and creates these new sort of dilemmas and changes. So the first of them is, as you say, after emancipation, where the until that time unified and, as far as we know from the manuscript record, fairly harmonious old believers suddenly become the opposite. They become incredibly acrimonious. And there is a schism within the priestly old believer community around Sepich in this area that's called the Upper Kama. That's their term for it, just around the base of the Kama River. It's 50 miles by 50 miles area. So it's not just around Sepich itself. It's a bit spread out, but Sepich was sort of the base and one of the most active areas. So I spend a chapter trying to figure out, along with 130 years of people in Sepich, what happened that created these two camps who claim to be entirely the same in terms of their service books, but completely won't talk to each other. So to this day in Sepich, you'd have Maksimovsky and Dyuminsky in the same town or in the same area, but they don't pray together. They don't talk to each other. They're different groups of elders. So this chapter goes through sort of three understandings of what happened and pays attention to the way in which this was a moment of rapid change that created differences in expectations about ethics that ultimately had these implications of schism for the community. So there's one very lengthy manuscript written by the Maksimovsky, which anathematizes and goes through all of the reasons why the Dyuminsky are to be expelled and declared as heretics according to the canons of the seven ecumenical councils. So that's sort of one version of ethics and how one is to judge others and relate to others according to these ancient books. The Dyuminsky also have a manuscript written in response to the Maksimovsky that says, no, you are the ones who are being anathematized. We are the right ones because of these other reasons. And it's very interesting, the Maksimovsky version, you would never know that these people were serfs or peasants or did anything other than get together and pray and read the ancient service books. In the Dyuminsky version, it's quite clear that this is taking place in a massively changing countryside. And many of their accusations against the Maksimovsky and against their leader, Maksim, are about him enriching himself and his communities being richer and excluding other communities. And so I can compare these accounts with actual census and survey data from the zemstvas at the time and see how the communities where the Maksimovsky were most popular were in fact becoming, were benefiting a lot more from the sort of post-emancipation agrarian capitalism that's going on. And so that sort of difference in life is caught up very much in these disputes and is part of the reason animating the turn to schism, to the decision that there's nothing left to do. There's no unified old believer community left in this area.
Now, you mentioned that these people you can still find in Sepich, these antagonism between these two communities. How did they preserve these identities from the late 19th century through the Soviet period to up to the present? What are the basis of memory of this kind of these antagonisms?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it's one of the things I try to figure out in the book. Initially, in the 19th century, this was a very regionally based antagonism. So in general, these priestless old believers, remember, there's no priesthood, there's no hierarchy, and it was always a very decentralized operation, right? So there would be a community of these elders who would gather in a particular town or a particular village or even a particular sort of hamlet, you know, much smaller than a village, four or five households, and they would have their own community of elders there. And they were all initially in communion with each other, as they would put it. The schism splits them, and it splits them along geographical lines. Those who are closer to Sepich and closer to the sort of hub of agrarian trade and capitalism and markets that Sepich is becoming turn into Maksimovsky. And many of those who are excluded from that sort of domain become Jominsky. So that spatial and economic divide is clearly what's going on early on. I think this changes dramatically in the Soviet period when those kinds of distinctions become much less important.
Right, right. So let's talk about the second moment of ethical reconfiguration in the Soviet period. Talk about Sepich in early Soviet period, and in particular how episodes of violence impacted the renegotiation of ethics in the town.
Right. So this is really the issue of the second part of the book, is how does the Soviet period change this whole ethical repertoire again, and throw into confusion and into very practical dilemmas all of these issues of gender and generation and how one relates to different people at different times. And the argument of the entire part, I'll come back to the violence issue, is that one of the ways in which the Soviet period reconfigured these things is by hardening this generational distinction between youth and elders, and entrenching it. And paradoxically, in part due to its sort of dogmatic insistence on the lack of another world, and its exclusion of any possibilities for religious practice, actually enabled old believers to continue their own very sharp distinction between this world and the other world. So there's a way in which sort of Soviet expectations about how religion worked enabled the preservation not only of old belief, but also of this distinction between Maksimovsky and Jominsky. So that's sort of the paradox I present in the second part, is that there's far from exterminating religion or changing it, although it changed it in many ways, obviously, the Soviet period overall preserved the possibility for making this very sharp aesthetic distinction between this world of youth and middle generation people and the other world for which elders were preparing. It was not at all uncommon for Communist Party members and good kolkhozniks and all these people to retire and then just grow out their beards and become old believers. Same kind of shift late in life that was happening in the 19th century.
That's actually quite fascinating, because most people, the general narrative would assume that, you know, the Soviet Union or the Soviet system destroyed the bonds of religion rather than allowing for their reassertion in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of what I'm wanting to say, is that we have to be very careful about how we think about what the impact of Soviet anti-religious campaigns and the general organization of Soviet life had on religious practice. It's not a single story. So you asked earlier about violence. Collectivization was particularly violent and particularly nasty in Sepich, because these were, in many cases, very rich, you know, obviously kulak families, who had done very well in the post-emancipation period and the early part of the 20th century, and entire families, entire villages were deported. But when we think about what implications this has for religion in particular, there were certainly anti-religious campaigns. Religion was a way in which you could get rid of some of these families, that you couldn't get rid of them another way, by accusing them of practicing old belief as a subversive. Activity, but the fact that there was no hierarchy meant that there was only minor trouble in finding a new replacement after a pastor had been arrested or sent off to a labor camp, or in some cases executed. The fact that this was a priestless set of communities, and there were no churches, there were none of the sort of archetypical spaces that the Soviet anti-religious establishment was sort of primed to shut down. They couldn't be found. They were not there. People gathered and had gathered for hundreds of years in each other's homes to pray. So Soviet expectations about religion were sort of calculated and calibrated in one way, and they clearly had effects. But old believers here were, I think, were accustomed to avoiding persecution and had developed a set of expectations and social structures that had long enabled them to avoid it, including deferred ritual practice. It's, you know, these were regular old kolkhozniks, you know, collective farm workers who were not really thinking about religion or the other world. It was hard to get, you know, hard to make anything about religion stick on them until such point as they were not so relevant to Soviet labor demands.
And I would imagine the Soviet authorities are in quite a bind where the majority of the religious community are elderly and they can't really go in and bust up the old as you know openly and violently as they may want to in certain cases.
That's right. They can't. They were effective at keeping young people away from the religious services. So these, you know, classically these communities would gather and they would be the old people doing the service, and then young people up through, you know, in the 19th century, probably up till marriage age. In the 20th century, it would have been, you know, younger school children would also attend, and it was at that point that they sort of learned before going off to work and before going off to marry, some of the practices. They learned how to read Slavonic texts and things like this. So the Soviets were successful at that. And they were certainly successful at keeping things out of the public eye. But they were not particularly successful at the plan of getting rid of old belief. And as a matter of fact, if you read the archives from the Council on Religious Affairs, they're tremendously frustrated because people are telling them there's all these old believers there and they turn up and no one knows who the leader is.
Right.
You know, it's all old women. You know, it's very difficult. And of course, all of the people who are in positions of power in the Soviet world, on the local scene, all of their parents, you know,
exactly.
Right. So there are competing loyalties here, and it's in that sort of you know, talk about relating to different people differently in different ethical ways at different times. You know, when their inspector comes and you're the person responsible for anti-religious propaganda in Sepich, but your family, you know, at the eldest sort of level is the practicing old believers. What do you do? I mean, those are the kinds of things I try to deal with in the book.
Okay, so one of the areas you talk about where the Soviet state, and speaking of attempts by the Soviet state to influence the ethics in Sepich, one area was its moral vision in terms of notions of labor and exchange. How did moral and material incentives for labor refashion ethical subjects and moral communities in Sepich?
Right. So this goes to the point I was making, that it's not really just a study of ethics and religion, and that even for anthropologists of religion and ethics, it's useful to think much more broadly about how these things happen. So I spend a substantial chapter thinking about the ethics of labor and the ethics of practical organization of Soviet collective and state farms. And I make think here about the sort of class Soviet state try to get labor out of its citizens and solve this perpetual problem of labor shortage and getting people to work. And what are the things that are exchanged here, and what are the sort of contexts of power? So I talk about the sort of classic topic of labor days and organization in the collective, in the period of collective farming. In the sort of early 1930s to mid-1960s. And then Sepich becomes a very famous state farm in the middle 1960s, and is until 1991. So, and curiously, one of the main ways in which the director of State Farm Sepich sought to create ethical socialist citizens is by using rituals. There's a famous film, which is sort of a propaganda film, called Sepich Weddings, which is which was shown on TV frequently and made in Sepich about the success of the director in keeping labor, keeping young people in the town to work the fields while, this is in the Brezhnev period, the much more popular tendency is for people to leave to the cities. And it's the sort of joys of rural life and weddings and young people all together and outside at dances and things like that. Just, and, you know, if you sort of look past the propaganda aspects of it, this was a significant part of the lives of many of these people who did choose to stay, is the participation in sort of youthful rituals, not having a great deal of socialist content, but were particularly, or at least that people understood them, or that wasn't the way in which people related to them. But it was an important part of ethical practice in this town for young people. And these, this very much became the sort of way in which young people related to each other and to the state farm in the later Soviet period in particular. So this has implications for the broader picture, because it's the one side of the generational divide that I'm talking about in chapter two, right, where all these young people are becoming very involved in staying in Sepich and very involved in sort of the this world of socialism at the same time as their elders are trying to withdraw from precisely that world.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the other world and how people, the elders in particular, who took on this aesthetic life, religious life later in life. How did how did they conduct religious practice in the Soviet period, and what tenets of old belief did they maintain?
Right. So quietly would be the first answer. To the extent that that practice continued, it was as it was across the Soviet period. Often at night, with blankets over the windows, people would assemble in each other's houses to pray by ones or twos rather than as big groups. Things that changed include a massive feminization of particularly leadership. But this is, and again, in concert with some broader things that are visible in religion across the Soviet and the former socialist world, men became much more identified with public labor and communism and the state farm and things like this. And women were as well, but, and this is one of those sort of double burden moments, they were not disassociated from the domestic spheres in which religion was still practiced. So so particularly as the Soviet period goes on, you get a population of old believers that's almost exclusively women. And this is the sort of Soviet era version or extension of the conversation that was going on back in the 1700s, 1800s about whether women should be in charge of religious communities or not, or who and how, but this changes drastically in the Soviet period, and it becomes, as I've been saying, a much older thing. It used to be that pastors, the people who headed these small decentralized communities, were themselves a bit younger. They were not the oldest of the old. They were probably a bit younger. Some of them were even middle generation. Sort of working age people who were elected to be leaders of religious communities. And that sort of mediating role of pastors between the younger world and the older world disappears. And that it becomes a very much, I call this the geriatricization of old belief in the Soviet period. So feminization and geriatricization are the two main trends that we see for believers. But on the other hand, you get... as I've been saying, this sort of preservation of the ability to make this sharp aesthetic distinction that is sort of characteristic of the ethical repertoire of these particular priestless old believers, much more so than either in the markets of the post-emancipation period or in the markets of the post-Soviet period, which turn out to be much more effective at chipping away at aestheticism than overt anti-religious campaigns.
What a great irony. And what happens to the tradition of manuscript production in the Soviet period?
Oh, excellent point. Yeah. I mean, this is something we haven't talked about, but a crucial element of the ethical repertoire and of the way it is materially manifest is through the circulation and production of manuscripts. So I talked about the manuscripts written by the Maksimovsky and Dyrminsky. And a massive manuscript tradition in this town and in this region. Production and the copying of manuscripts went on full force into the early part of the 20th century. It then begins to taper off. I think the degree of literacy in Slavonic, not necessarily in Russian, but in Church Slavonic, of many of the elders sort of drops off, and you end up with a bunch of manuscripts and sort of minutes of councils that I try to read and things like this in the 20th century, but they're much less beautiful, ornate Church Slavonic written on the sort of backs of, you know, classic Soviet notebooks and, mm-hmm. and things like this. So, so the production of new manuscripts drops off, but interest in these old manuscripts increases tremendously among Russian scholars, Soviet scholars, starting in the 1960s, 1970s. And these archaeographers I mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation, really scholars of ancient books and old Cyrillic manuscripts, turn up in Sepich and in dozens of old believer communities across the former Soviet Union looking for these old manuscripts in the 1970s. And they actually become some of the biggest allies and friends of these old women who are old believers, because they're interested in the manuscripts. They can read them. They can talk about them. They're very powerful allies to have. You know, I know someone from Moscow is not a small thing to say in the context of local politics in the Urals. So so manuscript production turned declines, but the interest in manuscripts and the sort of traffic in manuscripts, where manuscripts are being collected from this town and taken to the collections in Moscow. Frequently, the archaeographers traded manuscripts rather than just collecting them, right? So if you had an old, worn version of a particular service book, they would trade you for a newer one that you could use, but take the one with historical significance back to Moscow to study it.
Right, so these Soviet scholars are quite instrumental in the preservation of the traditions of old belief.
Yeah, absolutely. They're quite instrumental. They're instrumental in really invalidating these old women's, you know, the remaining in the 70s, 80s, you know, these remaining old women's beliefs and practices. And there's quite a touching exchange of letters between the scholars in Moscow and to some extent in Perm as well, and old believers. Expeditions happened every summer, but all through the winter, these folks would write back and forth to each other, and they were clearly became very close friends. For the scholars, you know, these old believers were the embodiment of ancient Russia. These largely dissident scholars, at least to some extent, were not particularly enamored of the Soviet project, and here was something outside of socialism for them. And for the old believers, these were powerful allies and people who were interested and friends and people who provided a lot of validation.
And it's interesting too, because in the 60s and in the 70s, you do have a number of Soviet scholars who are really trying to rebuild, or through their scholarship, whether it's in studying the medieval period or in these archaeographers that, in your case, they're trying to revive Russian national traditions and kind of facilitate the rebirth of, or the revitalization of, a Russian nationalism. Would you say that this is part of their mission?
I think it's part of that. Well, I think it's not the only thing they were doing. I mean, they're studying old beliefs. They're actually producing a lot of scholarship. But yes, I mean, to the extent that this was political, and it could be only very carefully talked about that way, because it is still religion and it is still the Soviet Union. But you know, the idea was, look, you know, here in this village, there are people who are preserving ancient Russian ways and ancient Russian texts. And we can see that because they still use the service book, which was around in, you know, the 18th century. And so that's a little bit of a caricature. That's not really a fair way to put it. But it was certainly cast as the discovery of ancient Russian traditions alive and well and preserved by this valiant community that had been seeking to keep the world at bay for many years, many centuries.
Now, the collapse of communism is the third historical moment in your story of ethical redefinition. But unlike the previous two, you say that the struggle for ethical reconfiguration is unstable and open-ended. Why do you say this?
Well, I think there are a couple things going on here. This is the third part of the book in which I shift, instead of dealing with sort of history and manuscripts and archives, I deal with present day field work and talking to people and living in Sepich and chasing cows and digging up potatoes and all the stuff that you do when you're, you know, living in a rural community for a year. And my sense at that point was that to the extent that there was another major reconfiguration of ethical life going on, it was still very uncertain. And people were still, you know, my primary field work was in 2001, 10 years after the end of the official end of socialism. And people were still puzzling through what to do. So it's that actual representation of trying to figure out things in the wake of a large-scale collapse that I'm wanting to get across. And there's also, for my own purposes, I'm writing against what was at that time still the major tendency in social science, which was to erase this sort of uncertainty and to say, well, now what comes after socialism is, well, we know, markets and democracy. And I was wanting to push back and say, well, no, actually, on the ground, it's incredibly uncertain what's happening. People are debating all this stuff. Things are rapidly changing in political, economic, social, cultural, religious ways. And it's important to recognize and work through and see the historical location of that set of dilemmas, rather than, you know, be confident and certain about what's emerging.
And now, 10 years after you did your field work, do you see a kind of consolidation of what post-Soviet ethics in this community is about?
It's a little hard to say. I mean, I'm onto a somewhat different project now, and I go back to Sepich when I can. You know, I've been back a few times, but you don't get the same sense in a quick visit to visit friends as I did in a year. So I think that it's probably the case that some things are solidifying a little bit more now. I think, you know, I would say that things are a little more settled down, and particular the sticking with old belief for the moment, one of the things that has changed tremendously is that Sepich is no longer entirely a priestless old believer town, a community of priestly old believers not taken over, but established a very strong presence in town. And I think that will probably continue. And that's part of the story I tell. And this third part is I wouldn't say that priestless old belief is disappearing, but it was challenged in a way that it has not been in 300 years in this town by a very active missionary priest from a priestly community of old believers in the nearby city, who was intent on building churches and converting people all around this area, and who was working in collaboration with a new post-Soviet possibility with the director of the former State Farm, the privatized State Farm. So there's that sort of alliance between church and state at the very local level has been a new possibility in the post-Soviet period and had serious implications for the ways in which people work through the sort of religious dimension of ethics in the post-Soviet period.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about the 1990s and the ethical confusion of the period. Now, what were some of the main issues that concerned the people of Sepich in that time?
Well, you know, I wrote this project, you know, as a grant and as a prospectus and everything to go think about religion and think about old belief. And when I turned up, this is not what people wanted to talk about. I mean, they would a little bit, but they were kind of like, well, why do you want to talk about all the old ladies and old belief and religion? What's really of concern to me is how are we privatizing this State Farm Sepich? And is the privatized commercial, I call it the commercial farm, which is a sort of post-Soviet cooperative, is it going to hold together? Is it going to go bankrupt as a business and Will it all be? Will we all sort of fall apart into individual households? So this distinction between having a collective farming enterprise in the post-Soviet period and just having a set of households with no place to actually go and work was one of the major concerns of post-Soviet Sepich.
And how did this kind of these concerns reshape the contours of the moral community in Sepich? I mean, in terms of Khozayin, Khozyanstva, issues of money, how did they regard these things?
Right. So we're, you know, we're back again in the domain of ethical subjects in the world, as people there, as old believers there might say. So this is sort of picking up the conversation about moral and material incentives and how do people work and what are the relevant communities of labor and money. And I trace two in two different chapters. One is a consideration of the household sector of the economy, which in Sepich as across the rural areas of the former Soviet Union has become much more important than it used to be. People have turned to their own barns and their own backyards to make money. So this becomes very important. And I talk about issues of social stratification in particular in these different households, who is able to make more money and how, and what the diagnoses and how people evaluate that and what kinds of connections there are among these households. So I have a chapter that focuses on the flow of money and moonshine among different households in exchange for labor and how we can track social stratification in town by seeing who pays whom for what, with what, who you pay moonshine to, who you pay money to. These are diagnostics of emerging levels of social stratification.
And now when it comes to the practice of old belief, what kind of ethical dilemmas did the old believer face in the 1990s? And also, what kind of issues do they face today? You mentioned the priest issue. But what
right.
other things?
So this is. So I mean, I guess the major way I frame this is that the what's going on in the world has changed dramatically once again, as in the Soviet period, as in the post-emancipation period, in the household sector, in these new relationships of the commercial the State Farm is no longer the main, it's the main business in town, but it no longer has state functions in the way that it did in the Soviet period. So this is the third time in the book that I asked this question: how do these changing relationships in this world create new dilemmas for old believers? And one of them is, as I mentioned, the director of the commercial farm, who was in a previous incarnation the director of State Farm Sepich, struck up this alliance with this priest from out of town, and the church, the new church, was built with State Farm funds and with State Farm. They still call it the State Farm, which is why I sort of slipped into the Soviet speak. But it's really the commercial farm. It's built this privatized commercial farm. It's built this this church, and this priest has turned up to. For services once a month, and by universal acclamation, he's very deeply knowledgeable, and the services are beautiful and well run. There's no question, even for most of the priestess old believers in town, that this guy knows what he's doing. And it has sort of put them on the defensive, because a lot of these old women, they're not quite sure which prayers to read anymore. They're not quite as assertively proficient as this very young and masculine and assertive and confident priest. But on the other hand, this priest is quite clearly part of the world, right? I mean, he's the whole church was built by commercial farm money. And, is this an inappropriate mixing of the worlds, of the kind of thing that was, that would put one's soul in mortal danger for the ascetics of the old days in Sepich, right? So here's a kind of dilemma, right? Do I go to the new church, or do I stick with these old ladies? And the new church, it looks like they, this priest knows what he's doing, and the rituals are effective, and it's beautiful, and it's all done the right way. But on the other hand, it's very closely implicated in the relationships of this world. And that is worrying So those are kind of the things that people have to make decisions about.
Right, and I would imagine too, I mean, the priest is kind of a symbol of this too, but this world is increasingly encroaching on the other world in terms of technology, in terms of labor flows, money, and how one lives their kind of postmodern life.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. This world is encroaching to a greater extent in the Soviet period. You know, in the chapter where I talk about the exchange of moonshine and rubles, I also talk about the exchange of dollars. I mean, people there were, you know, as quick to exchange $100 bills as anyone else in the, you know, in the 1990s in Russia. So yes, this world is becoming more, more present and much broader, although, you know, it always was to some extent there as a threat. And certainly in the post-emancipation period, very similar sort of marketization, bringing unfamiliar forces and unfamiliar people. So that's really the comparison set in this particular town is the other, the earlier period of marketization.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and I really encourage everyone to read it. I learned a lot, not just about old belief, but a way to look at ethics over a long period of history. It's incredibly informative, both analytically and information. So just to wrap up the interview, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm still working on a project in the Perm region, but it is no longer in Sepik. It's going to be a broader ethnography of the Perm region, and it's only going to be in the post-Soviet period. As much as I like the historical part of this of the earlier book, this is going to be a shorter term project, and it's about emergence of the Perm region as a significant oil-producing region in the post-Soviet period, and what kinds of implications this has had on a regional level for the reconfiguration of culture and society. So I'm interested in things like how oil and gas companies are involved in corporate social responsibility projects, how an oil boom at the local level is felt and has implications for the production of culture, and things like this. So, in some ways, I'm continuing this line that I had in the first book about trying to think about the intersection of political economy and culture in the practical making of lives. But in some ways, in now thinking about the oil industry, I'm quite far from Sepik in the sort of social and cultural landscape of the Perm region.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look forward to seeing, since oil plays such a, in natural gas plays such a huge role in contemporary Russian life, I can't wait to see what you come up with.
Well, it does. And most of the approaches these days are at the level of, you know, the Kremlin and the oligarchs.
Exactly.
And all the stuff. And I'm trying to do sort of maybe not a worm's eye view, but at least a regional level view of how these things actually have implications for reshaping people's lives.
Well, great. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me about your book.
Well, thank you for the questions. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, Sean.
I've been speaking with Doug Rogers about his book, The Old Faith in the Russian Land, a Historical Ethnography of Ethics in the Urals. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Once again, I'm Sean Guillory, your host for New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies. If you're interested in hearing more interviews by the New Books Network, please go to newbooksnetwork.com. And be sure to tune in next time when I talk to Daniel Treisman about his book, The Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. Until then, goodbye.
Оттого-то знать не весел дом, в котором мы живем, надо бы лампочку повесить. Денег все не соберем.